Hi, I'm David Price, author of The Pixar Touch, The Making of a Company, and you're listening to the Pixar Podcast.
To infinity and beyond!
So, how long is this going to take?
Squirrel!
You can't rush art.
No, good.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now.
What's the point of going out there? They'll only laugh at me.
A stranger from the outside.
Greetings.
Hello there, Pixar fans. Welcome again to another episode of the Pixar Podcast. This is episode number 130. ThePixarPodcast.com/130 is where you can find the show notes for this episode. And with me today, I'm Derek Clements. With me today are two very special guests. The first returning to the Pixar Podcast is Hunter Phillips. Hello, Hunter.
Hi, how's it going?
Really great. It's great to have you on. We're going to talk some good dinosaur stuff today. And also on the podcast for the first time, but somebody that I've admired for a long time and really excited to have him on the show, is Jim Hill of Jim Hill Media. Hello, Jim.
Hey. Hello there. Thanks for the invite. Again, you know, we've gotten to chat at a couple of, the Pixar press events and that sort of thing. And had a good time hanging out, so it's nice to get to do this again.
I know, yeah, it's really great to have you on the show, and it's really fun to talk to you when we get together in person and stuff. So, and it was actually, Jim, it was your post on The Good Dinosaur on your site, and also it was a Huffington Post article. By the way, so is that like a gig that you have that, like, you just do a lot of your posts on Huffington Post as well?
Well, I mean, it's such a weird thing. I mean, I honestly... You know, I'm an old print and, a newspaper magazine guy. And I literally got this gig from a tweet. I mean, just one day, Nancy and I are in the car. We're driving to a family party. And I get this note from a gentleman named Jordan Zakarin. He was the head editor of the entertainment page at that time. And he just sent me a note to the effect of, hey, I really like that story you posted today. And you know, and again, this, I'm just getting started with tweeting at this point because I'm a technological idiot. I'm still using a Brownie camera at this point, guys, kind of behind the curve. And so, I turned to Nancy and say, you could type thank you. and she's like, oh, okay. So she typed thank you on her phone. And like 6 seconds later, another note comes back and is like, hey, can I talk to you? And long story short, he pitches me. It's like, love the stuff you've done. We're trying to expand our Disney coverage. Would you like to come on board as our Disney guy? And it's like, I do you remember that moment in The Rescuers where the mice come in to rescue Penny? And she's like, didn't you bring anybody big with you? And it's like, I kept thinking, shouldn't you be offering this to a grown-up? I mean, somebody, not that the idiot who typed on the web, but it's like, no, that's that was June of 2011. I've been doing it ever since. Great. It's a great gig, but weird, just the thing of when you work for the Huffington Post, which just the other day I was looking, we're like, out of everything that's on the web, we're like 34.
Wow.
In traffic. I mean, like, I don't know what's ahead of us. I'm assuming it's porn.
Yeah.
But, it's the notion, we're 34.
Yeah.
And so the joke I make is the nice thing about working with the Huffington Post is you get a much better class of people saying no. when you ask, can I interview? No. But thank you.
Yeah.
At least you get that thank you at the end.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's great.
We were talking about Pixar before I started remembering.
Well, it's really great to have you on. And listeners will probably know that you're somewhat of a Disney expert and you always have really good analysis. So we'll get into some cool stuff today. Mm-hmm. But let me throw it first to Hunter. So after I released our review of the Good Dinosaur, which was quite a heated review. I was defending the film, thought it was doing some interesting stuff that Pixar hadn't done before. But a couple of the other co-hosts didn't like it so much. So we had a nice heated debate. But afterwards, I got a text from Hunter and kind of you claimed to be on Team Good Dinosaur and Team Derek in that conversation. So I was happy about that. But let me throw it to you first to just kind of what are your thoughts on the film and kind of what as it's been a few weeks, it's been out for a few weeks now. And so you've had time to digest it. What do you think? Good Dinosaur.
Yeah, gosh. I guess to be blunt, I love this movie. I really, really love it. And I think what I texted you was that you'd mentioned it being one of Pixar's better movies in that first podcast. And I think I'd probably, for me, go as far as to say it's one of their very best movies. It just, the thing that's so exciting to me about it is maybe a result of what we're going to talk about today and kind of the developmental stuff. And that, you know, a lot of the popular discussion around Pixar movies tends to be about like sharing blog posts about their story meetings and their rules and like just how managed, you know, their movies tend to be, which is great, which is terrific. And their movies work. But this movie felt loose and kind of shaggy and rambly in a way that I don't usually associate with Pixar. And I think because of that and how, you know, loose it felt like the first Pixar movie that was really, really mythical for me. And like it tapped into some really primal stuff and reminded me of some of my very favorite movies, you know, like Werner Herzog stuff or Carol Ballard's Black Stallion. Like it felt so, there was so much sublime stuff to it that just felt gigantic and unknowable. And I think I texted you earlier today that the first 45 minutes of The Force Awakens is a lot like that too.
Awesome.
And I think my friend said to me as we walked out of the theater that it's like the first Pixar movie that he felt like didn't get storied to death. Which is funny because I think this movie did get storied to death in order to become what it was. But it just it's a nice rambling. I mean, and it's a Western, which is terrific. It's nice to pack that in. And I'm originally from the region that they, you know, topographically mapped for this movie. And so talking to my little cousins over Thanksgiving about it, to hear them be so excited about seeing our home, you know, in a, you know, rendered in a movie is pretty cool.
Yeah.
If I could jump in here for just
please,
a sec.
Yeah.
It's interesting you say, you know, this is a Western, and believe me, I'm not going to fight you on that point. In fact, you know, I'm pretty much in both of your corners in regard to The Good Dinosaur. I love this movie. I love it for its simplicity, for its purity. But at the same time, in talking with folks at the studio, they actually, I was told by a friend who works at the studio that they were told when talking with the press, if somebody says it's a Western, tell them, please don't call it a Western. They were so worried that people would hear, oh, it's a Western. Well, I don't like Westerns. I'm not going to that. That, you know, there was, you know, and again, the irony is you look at this thing and, you know, from the T-Rexes and that sort of thing, this is a Western.
Yes.
You know, and
cowboys.
Just the, yeah. And just the, you know, boy lost in the wilderness. There's so many of the tropes from the classic, like the John Ford movies that this does. And
the cinematography too. The cinematography is so Western as well.
Absolutely. But but again, from the studio's point of view, they viewed we put it in the Western box, that limits the audience, and so let's not do that. So
yeah,
anyway, I'm
fascinating.
I'm sorry, Hunter, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just thought chime in with that.
No, that's great. Because I don't think this movie follows, you know, a lot of beats of like you know, like Rango. It's not so deliberately a specific Western, and more it's a wilderness movie. It's a survival movie in a lot of ways. And so it doesn't follow kind of I think the idea of a Western that people are tired of and have been for decades is the gunslinger type thing, is the Clint Eastwood idea. But there's so much room for frontier movies. And, you know, I guess I've talked to people about The Good Dinosaur who are like, I just wish there were more dinosaurs around and there was more of a... And I'm like, I love how sparse it is and how everything we run into is kind of exciting because it's, you know, it is this wilderness and these are kind of the scavengy frontier dinosaurs. That's so much more exciting to me than whatever a dinosaur city looks like, which I think was brought up in the initial review on the podcast.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is interesting because in that initial review, Scott, who was the main... sort of detractor from the film, really said that that's what he wanted to see. He wanted to see a big, like, big community of dinosaurs and, like, what's that going to look like and how do they evolve to do stuff. And as we'll get into, earlier versions of the film, it appears was more like what Scott wanted it to be and maybe is even – more what you might expect from a typical Pixar plot. The thing that I'll say also about the film before we get into all that is that, it is so much more simple than most Pixar films in the plot, in the story. And you're just left with, like you're saying, wilderness and survival and this big epic stuff. So there's not as much, you know, to chew on plot wise and stuff, which is kind of a new thing for Pixar. But there's certainly a lot of beauty in it. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at, Hunter.
Yeah, it's you know, because I can't help but think of it in regards to Inside Out. Like, that's the thing I keep stacking it against, just by proximity. And Inside Out had so much thematically to try and like swallow, and so much, there is so dense, and there's so much at the fringes of it that I just want to know more about. But Good Dinosaur, moment to moment, just feels so good and kind of crunchy. Like, I can't describe it in quantifiable movie words, but it just, it's so in control of its emotion. I think because it's whatever we're going to call story is so simple that it can like kind of bask in like facial expressions and like landscapes and really just like, I keep going back to Primal, and like, it's just like a movie that feels like it came out of the ooze, you know? It's, I mean, that first shot of the Papa Dinosaur, like just walking, as soon as his head went down to the ground and started plowing, I was like, this movie's for me.
Yes.
Like, that was all I needed.
What was it about that?
I think it's so, see, this is all just getting into me as a person and not in any kind of way good criticism,
right?
But it's just, you know, movies that feel tactile are great, and things that just, I'm way more into movies that ride a feeling than, a story.
Yeah.
And this movie so, just has a handle on it. I think that's Pete Sohn. I think that is just a great, I don't know. The words are escaping me right now, but it's a movie that knows what it's doing at every moment. And I think it's like the rambling nature kind of defies that and makes people give it a little less credit than it deserves.
Yeah.
Because it's a movie that can get away with 30 seconds of a drug trip and then never acknowledge it. You know, that's the spirit of animated movies that I kind of, that's the early Disney structure, right?
Yeah.
That's what's so great.
Yeah. Well, anything to add to any of that, Jim?
You know, I guess for me, one thing that kind of struck me is that I think about it, that one of the things that really should have been an impossible, the notion of the photorealistic backgrounds and the cartoony design on top of them. I mean, I remember hearing that was what they were shooting for. And it's like, all I could think of was Disney's Dinosaur, you know, where they actually shot live action background plates.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, and that whole notion of, okay, we'll go with realism and then we'll layer the, you know, the realistic yet stylized dinosaurs on top of that. And how, you know, I mean, that film never worked, you know, and I was genuinely concerned when I heard, oh, and we're going to go cartoony, and it works. I mean, there's a beautiful balance to it. In fact, you know, I remember talking with Pete about, you know, just there are frames of this thing you could hang on the wall. I mean, it's just, it's a beautiful looking film, but at the same time, just the purity of the story or the, I mean, how unlikely it is that you buy into. I mean, think about it. I remember I was on the phone talking with Nancy about, you know, after they'd shown us the footage at about half the movie at Pixar, and talking about it, it's like, you know, this poor kid who's lost in the wilderness and gets rescued by a dog, except the kid is a dinosaur and the dog is a human.
Yeah.
But you buy into this. You buy into this weird relationship. And I love the callback to the, for example, the scene down by the river where the two of them are, you know, first really bonding about explaining, you know, through basically pantomime, how, you know, what happened to their families. And then that wonderful moment where, sorry, spoiler folks, but when the humans come and you know, that Spot, you know, Arlo actually forces Spot to go.
Right.
And actually, you know, draws the circle around them like, this is your family now. That's brilliant storytelling. I mean, just again, you know, just I enjoyed this, and again, which is why it's kind of confounding to look at what I consider one of the best things pictures done in probably the last 5 to 10 years, and it's like, okay, where are the people?
Yeah,
you know.
Sorry, it's confounding to me too, because there are things. I'm glad you brought up the people at the end, because that first image of the old man on the horizon is about as like perfect and sublime an image as anything in the cartoon since, you know, like the wolf in Fantastic Mr. Fox, which I guess they're kind of the same image now that I think about it, but they're both incredible. But this movie has been frustrating for me because of how weak the criticism surrounding it has been. I felt like people, and I've read a lot of reviews of it, have just not tried to engage with it at all, because the absolute worst criticism I've heard is just how unbelievable this world is and how, you know, I think the front page of my local newspaper said the baffling dinosaur and how could there be a world in which humans didn't evolve in these dinosaurs? And I'm like, that's not movie criticism. That is so divorced from what this movie is about. And if you are hung up on that kind of base of the story, then I think you should probably just not watch movies anymore. Maybe they're not for you.
Yeah, nice. It is interesting to see the response it's getting. And certainly I think that the proximity to Inside Out, people are so quick to dismiss this one because it's different and stuff. I don't know. I agree with you, Hunter.
Though, again, what's kind of intriguing is I honestly believe that Inside Out being released in the exact same year is part of what we're dealing with here in regard to what's happening with Good Dinosaur's box office. In fact, honestly, when you start to look at the poor slot that Peter and the production team wound up with. I mean, think about this, okay? You've got, you know, Inside Out came out on Blu-ray and DVD after, you know, a very successful run this summer on November 2nd, 2015, okay? Just a little more than 3 weeks later, Good Dinosaur opens in theaters on November 25th. And then, to sort of add insult to injury, 3 weeks after that, what opens but The Force Awakens?
Right.
All right. Which, you know, honestly, is taking the oxygen out of the room for every other film on the planet.
Because, of course,
this is an event film. This is, you know, the first, you know, brand new Star Wars film in 10 years and, you know, the might of the Disney company behind it. And, you know, in fact, it always kind of shocks me at this point that, you know, occasionally I look up at the moon and, wow, Disney didn't get the Star Wars advertising up there. You know,
they
missed something. You know, I mean, because I reach into my fridge and I'm pulling in an R2-D2 flavored, or colored and shaped, you know, coffee creamer. I mean, you know, it was everywhere.
Yep.
And so poor Good Dinosaur wounds up, you know, by default because of all its production issues with this slot.
Yes.
And I honestly think this isn't a referendum on the quality of this film. I think this is more a referendum on, and forgive me, this is probably not the term to use, but Pixar fatigue. You know, I mean, for example, there are a lot of folks at Disney who look at what happened with the gross of Lion King. And a lot of people believe that one of the reasons that Lion King did as well as it did was that it had been almost 18 months since Aladdin opened in November 13th, 1992. Lion King didn't open until June of 94. So there was this hunger out there. For, you know, it's like, hey, you know, I haven't, you know, we really like that last Disney movie and, you know, when's the next one coming? And so, you know, like, and there was a hungry audience where, you know, conversely, if you look at the situation between Inside Out and Good Dinosaur opening the same year, you have this fat and happy audience that's yes. just, you know, enjoyed Inside Out. And hey, it's out on Blu-ray and I'm going to, you know, pay my $15 or $20 to buy this. And it's like, oh, yeah. Oh, another one. Okay. You know, it's like they were still fat and happy. I mean, you know, why would you rush out to go to the new thing
right.
when you're still, you know, oh, Bing Bong died.
Right.
Oh,
yes.
You know, so.
Yeah. It's really, you know, really good point.
No, so, it's, I don't know.
It's true. And we'll see going forward because the next Pixar movie is coming out in 6 months, like, you know, 6 months from now. So that's going to continue. But I don't think that Finding Dory will probably have the same fatigue just because Finding Nemo made so much money. That was a really big game changer for Pixar, I think, from a public brand perspective. So I'm sure that movie will not suffer. But
I know that Finding Dory will probably do very, very well. But the fear that I have after Good Dinosaur not doing so well after Inside Out is that it reverses or neutralizes the like original idea goodwill yeah. that Inside Out brought.
Right.
And, you know, animated movies, I guess the turnaround is so long that it'll be well into the 2020s before we see any effects of anything that's happening now.
Right.
But I worry whenever a movie that's not a sequel struggles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so let's get into the struggles of The Good Dinosaur a little bit more. And in particular, I mean, there's two. We've kind of touched on the box office struggle, mm-hmm. but there's also the production struggle. And this is not new, that in the process of making a film at Pixar, you know, they don't always work. In fact, they often don't work for a while. And sometimes, somewhat frequently, actually, they have to get a new director. It happened with Brave. It happened with Ratatouille. It happened with Toy Story 2. You know, it happens a lot. And it's not to say that that is going to ruin the movie. And in fact, often we don't really ever get a sense of what the other version of the original version of the film would have looked like. But the interesting thing with The Good Dinosaur, and I really discovered this, Jim, by reading your post about that's titled "By Thinning the Good Dinosaur's Herd, Pixar Animation Studios Went Up with a Far Better Film." In that blog post, you have some images of toys.
Mm-hmm.
And these toys blew my mind because I had been pretty excited about the Good Dinosaur toys because I just think the character designs are so appealing that I love these. I love my Arlo and Spot, and they're under my Christmas tree right now and things like that. I love the design of them. And there were other dinosaurs that I saw in the store that I didn't pick up at the time, but after reading your blog post, I went right back to the store to go pick up the ones that I had missed because, well, talk about these. We have these on the shelves right now. We have characters like Mary Alice the Stegosaurus, and we have Will the Triceratops. We have these people. Could you just go into who these are and how they got on the shelves, Jim?
Well, I get that you know, in fact, it's the folks who actually went to the D23 Expo in 2013 who, unless they show up as extras on, you know, either the upcoming Good Dinosaur Blu-ray or DVD or some other version of this further down the line, but they actually got to see these characters in action. There was a presentation at that event where they had the three of the art directors on stage. I'm blanking who was there at the moment, but and they actually showed sort of the initial opening of this film. And basically what it was is it showed this, for lack of a better term, an Amish community. That that each of the dinosaurs had evolved to the point where they were using their body types, their attributes to ease with farming. I mean, for example, the Triceratops were the ones who actually, you know, because of the horns and their giant bone plate on the head, they were effectively the bulldozers. They cleared the land, and then coming in behind them was the apatosaurs. And, you know, in fact, this is where we got to meet Arlo's family, who, as Hunter said, how much he enjoyed watching the dinosaur with his face in the dirt plowing the furrow for the soil. That's what they did. And then I guess they were then supposed to watch over the crop. And then when it came harvest time, Here come the stegosauruses through, and because of the spikes on the end of their tail, they would harvest the crops, just sort of literally cut them down. Coming in behind them were basic pachyosauruses. They're basically a duck-billed dinosaur, but they have, they have forearms that could gather up crops, which they would then in turn pile on the back of ankylosauruses, who would carry it to the barns. And so you had this very, if you've ever seen the Peter Weir movie Witness of the how the Amish community farms, this was that kind of style, that kind of tone. And you eventually set up the fact that the brontosauruses watched over the crops during the during the growing, and they had to deal with these giant bugs that would come in and take care, go after the crops. And and so during this part of the movie is when we get to meet Arlo, who at this point is not an 11-year-old boy, but is I've heard 17, I've also heard 19 to 21-year-old. I mean, he's basically a man child. He's kind of a goofy, and also at this point he has two brothers, older brothers, I want to say.
Well, and by the way, he would have been voiced by who? Neil Patrick Harris?
No, Neil Patrick Harris was actually one of the brothers.
Okay.
And so he's watching over the bugs one day, and he actually likes the bugs. He thinks they're colorful and interesting, and he's trying to catalog them. And one day there's one he doesn't recognize, and he sort of catches it, rolls it over, and it's a small human boy who's, in order to sneak into the field, has dressed himself in a primitive bug costume. And this is how the relationship starts, that he sort of adopts him. And in fact, the other thing at the D23 Expo, they actually ran some test footage of Arlo and Spot at that point. And this is not a 45-foot tall version of I guess in the film Arlo is supposed to be 22 feet tall, or
okay.
Yeah, this is an older, taller dinosaur. So at one point there's a scene where Spot is running up Arlo's neck and actually climbs inside his mouth and hangs off of his uvula. it's swinging off of the tonsils.
Yeah.
And it was one of these things where there were a lot of ideas that they tried. Yeah. And in fact, talking with both Peter and Denise Rehm, Denise came in as the second producer when John Walker, who was the original producer of this project, left to go work with Brad Bird on Tomorrowland.
Yeah.
And Denise was looking at all of the footage and everything that had been pulled together, and there were some wonderful ideas and there was some amazing animation, but there was just so much stuff. There was a film in there somewhere. The problem was that they had this very busy story of, the dinosaur world, the Amish community that farmed. And then there was Arlo and his father, who was, sort of a stern farmer, and Arlo who wanted to do, artsy fartsy kinds of things. So there was a dynamic with the dad. And then there was the, relationship with, between Arlo and Spot, and then they go off on an adventure, some calamity happens. I could never get them. And in fact, I guess the problem was the calamity kept changing, but they could never settle on the right mix of elements. And and that's in the end why, Denise was the one who just like, we have to shut this down. We have to. At this point, Bob had actually stepped away. I think that's one of the things that people really don't understand, is that when Peter and Denise came to the D23 Expo and stood on stage as part of the overlook of what Disney Animation and Pixar were going to be doing for the next, 2, 3, 4 years, they had already shut the film down. And they were there putting the best possible face on the project. But the film, in fact, that's the irony, that anybody who was in that presentation, you know, and with the three art directors, they had no clue that they were never going to get to see this movie, that what they were seeing had already been shut down. And but yeah, that they, I guess they shut it down or put the brakes on as early as June. And, you know, it wasn't till two weeks after the D23 Expo that they finally went, hey, you know, that movie we're making, maybe we're not making it. So, and of course, in you know, you have to understand that Disney, I mean, look, you know, that if you dig back down into the Good Dinosaur's history, you know, its original release date was actually November 27, 2013. And in April of 2002, they decided, all right, we're obviously having some story problems. Let's shift it, you know, push this out to May
2012. Yeah, sorry.
2014, actually.
Right. That's when they made the decision to shift it back.
Yeah. And, you know, what's fascinating is, you know, the slot they went in, you know, the film that went into the slot they abandoned?
Was it Frozen? Frozen.
All right. And, you know, Frozen, which went on to make more money than God.
Yeah.
And then September of 2013, you know, so once again, another pushback that you know, we're going from May 30th, 2014 to November 25th. And that, you know, but that was kind of a saving grace for Finding Dory, because remember, the original story for Finding Dory was basically that her parents were trapped at a SeaWorld-like theme park.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And of course, what with Blackfish happening, it's like, all right, maybe we don't want to be in a SeaWorld theme park.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so they, you know, they took advantage of the fact that it's like, yes, please take our release date. Absolutely. You go right ahead. We'll just be back here fixing our story problems.
Yeah.
And Disney, in turn, had to fill the May 30th, 2014 slot, and that's where they moved Maleficent to, which actually did pretty good, business in that slot. But, I think personally, again, I think Peter and Denise and their really, really talented crew actually fixed all of the problems. I don't, you know, that whatever story murk they were dealing with, there's a clarity, there's a purity. But at the same time, you just cannot, numbers don't lie, guys. All right. I mean, but just before we started doing the show today, I went on Box Office Mojo. And as of right now, we're recording this on December 16th, 2015.
Okay. December 18th, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're on the 18th. But the numbers that are available on Box Office Mojo are only up to the 16th.
Right.
So that's the 22nd day that Good Dinosaur has been released. And as of that day, it's grossed $91,625,000 and change.
Yeah.
And internationally, the film's done $78 million. Now, to put that in perspective, Inside Out, when it had hit its 22nd day in release, it was already up to $271 million. I mean, it had basically done three times the business that Good Dinosaur has done to this point. You know, and if we start stepping backwards, Monster University, 22 days out, had done $230 million. Brave had done $188 million domestic. And I thought, okay, but it's not fair to compare what a movie does during the summer,
right,
to what a film that's released in the fall does. And remember,
and Pixar, less than a month before Star Wars.
Yeah. And, you know, so I jumped backwards and started looking at the Pixar films that did in fact get released in November. And right. So the first one was obviously Toy Story back in November 26, 1995. And, that May, at this point, 22 days into its domestic release, it had made $85 million. Hmm. But that's 1995 money.
Right.
You know? And likewise, if we start marching down, Bug's Life, November 25th, 1998, that actually was kind of a step down box office wise from Toy Story, that only made $174 million 22 days out. And then, but now, you know, you start to watch the numbers climb. You know, Toy Story 2 on November 1999, that was $126 million 22 days out. Monsters, Inc., $178 million 22 days out. And that's November 2001. And Incredibles 22 days out had grossed, you know, over $200 million. So, you know, and honestly, you have to understand that when you're talking show business, as far as Hollywood is concerned, the most important word there is business. So, yes, there's a lot of people right now who are looking at the, you know, and you've seen the stories. You've seen the same stories I have about, you know, Pixar's first flop or Pixar's first disappointment or however people want to say this. And it just did. And it makes me crazy because it's like, you know, it's that's not a disappointing film. You know, that's a film that's going to stand the test of time. And in fact, I would argue that, you know, what we're really looking at is probably the Pixar equivalent of The Iron Giant. That this is going to be one of those films where the people who saw it and loved it are going to hype it and, you know, and treasure it and talk it up to friends. And, you know, it will have this second flowering further down the line. But, you know, the problem is that everything that Pixar has done that preceded this has done such gangbuster business.
Right.
Even if they haven't been as well reviewed, I mean, Cars 2 was maybe the first time a Pixar film got generally kind of mixed to negative reviews. This one is getting better reviews, but yeah, the box office is the first real hit.
I think again we're dealing with Pixar fatigue, and the kicker, the absolute kicker. I was kind of hoping that the cavalry was going to come over the hill with this one, in that. You know, okay, so it didn't do well theatrically or as well as everybody had hoped. But hey, you know, Blu-ray, DVD, you know, that, and face it, this, you know, once people actually do get to see this, they're going to love this movie. But the hard reality there is, and again, in a weird sort of way, just as The Force Awakens is sort of sucking the oxygen out of the room, you know, and derailing Good Dinosaur's box office potential for its domestic release, there's something coming, you know, that will actually hinder Good Dinosaur when it hits Blu-ray and DVD, which, by the way, that's according to my research, that's going to be November 16th of 2016.
Sorry, November 16th or?
Oh, excuse me, February.
Okay, February. February 16th, okay.
February 16th, 2016.
Okay.
So what's coming down the road that's actually going to cause trouble here? Well, as it turns out, you know, I'm sure all of us know the Don Bluth movie, The Land Before Time.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, more to the point, if we don't know the movie, we know all of the video premieres.
Yes.
You know, you may not have seen them, but you know they're out there.
Yeah.
You know, Littlefoot has been, I think at this point, it's like, you know, there have been, you know, the original film and then there have been 12 home premieres. But it turns out there's a 14th, you know, the 14th film, the 13th home premiere, the 13th sequel, continuation, whatever you call it at this point, is coming out next year. It's called Land Before Time, Journey of the Brave. And the thing that's going to make Pixar fans crazy is it's coming out on February 2nd. It's coming out 2 weeks before The Good Dinosaur on Blu-ray and DVD.
Oh,
and in
boy.
Fact, my understanding is Universal timed it. And by the way, that's again, this is a Universal Pictures home premiere project. They deliberately timed it because they thought, they were actually looking to ride on Pixar's coattails. They just figured that there would be this appetite out there after Pixar had released its latest hit, you know, the dinosaur film. And, you know, what better, you know, way to take advantage of people who were chomping at the bit to get their hands on The Good Dinosaur than to, hey, look, Littlefoot's out, you know, and you can pick this up 2 weeks before you get to see Arlo and Spot. So, so it's not going to be, you know, fun. You know, that's that. In fact, you will see another wave of stories about, you know, Pixar's first financial disappointment.
Yeah.
Which, again, if you know, it just, it's so bizarre to live in a world where it's like, it only made $91 million,
totally.
You know?
Yeah.
If somebody would only hand me only $91 million, you know, I could get over that disappointment. I could live with that, you know?
Totally, totally. Well, that's a great sort of historical snapshot of this gym. Hunter, anything from any of that you want to comment on or ask more about?
Yeah, I'm kind of, I don't know. It's odd because a lot of these these are pretty good, solid historical examples. But I wish I knew, like, it's just not good. You know, it's not good enough for me to know, to say that there's Pixar fatigue or something, like, even though it makes sense. I just don't want to accept that because I remember when they announced untitled Pixar movie about dinosaurs, yeah, an untitled Pixar movie that takes you inside the mind. I was like, well, shoot, that mind one's a stretch. But if there's one thing that kids and their parents love, it is dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And of all the concepts that could have, you know, been the one to be a disappointment, this surprises me,
yeah,
more than I think any other. It's just baffling. And it must be a November release and it must be the inside up, but it seems like a perfect storm of troubles that, and admittedly a lot of headlines that focus too much on development issues that most Pixar movies go through.
Yeah, but realistically, I mean, honestly, do you think people, I mean, look, you know, the three of us sitting here, you know, we love talking about sort of inside baseball about Pixar,
right?
You know,
right,
just get in there and find out what happened. But the person who's at the multiplex with their kid or who's making the decision that what are we going to go see this weekend, I don't think they really care or know about, you know, Bob Peterson stepping aside and Peter Son, you know, stepping in and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand what it was that didn't, you know, it's Pixar. I mean, which is literally, you know, the you know, there are so few rock solid film brands. I mean, as we've just proved this past, you know, as we're recording this, one of them seems to be Star Wars, you know, though I don't know if you guys are have your browsers open while you're you know, we're recording here. But the interesting bit of news, in the same breath that, you know, that you know, the financial press is talking about how, you know, The Force Awakens is going to make $200 million domestic this weekend, Disney stock is tanking right now.
What?
Yes, there's a headline. Variety is running right now, Disney shares hammered as the Dow plunges 2%. So, and it seems to be, you know, on the back where it's like, it's only making $200 million. Bah! Oh, we thought it would do so much better, which tells you the truly crazy world of financial expectations we live in right now.
Yeah. Well, and 2015 is that, I think, that crazy year too. Because think about all the huge movies we've had. I mean, think about the other big dinosaur movie that we had this year that
yeah,
blew expectations.
There's that.
You know,
there's that.
Yeah.
It's difficult because I think of Quentin Tarantino being so upset that The Hateful Eight won't be able to play the Cinerama Dome because of Star Wars bookings. And it's so fascinating to me that we're so overcrowded with movies right now.
Right.
And I wonder if beyond a Pixar fatigue, beyond any kind of, there's just, but I guess we're talking about a different space because we're talking about family movies, but it just generally seems like because of the overcrowding, we're in a situation where even family movies are required to perform on their opening weekend or else they're done for. Until home video, because even as I talk to my uncles and they have kids in Idaho, you know, these are people who are potato salesmen and they don't know, you know, anything. They read maybe blurb reviews in the Idaho Falls paper, but even there, they mention for some reason Good Dinosaur being a troubled production, or they see that it didn't make that much money in its opening weekend. And for people in middle America who wait for Discount Tuesday to go to the movies or for something, that opening weekend being a relative disappointment, like, really shakes up expectations. And it's just hard to know what goes wrong.
Yeah. It really does seem like this movie is going to slip through the cracks. But the reason that I wanted to put this episode together, you guys, and have you guys on is because I think that talking about just kind of reflecting on this story, I think redeems the movie in some ways. And I think that some people that may be quick to dismiss it, I think that understanding a little bit about the backstory and sort of looking at it in the context and the box office in context and things, I think gives it more richness. And I want to go back into that Bob Peterson version, because again, we don't usually know what the original versions look like, but we have all these relics. You know, we mentioned the toys. We also have that poster. You guys remember the poster that came out a while back?
Yeah.
Many years ago. So we have these artifacts that kind of are in the public that we're kind of all grappling with. And also the whole fact that the voice cast was totally, changed. We have all these things that I think that, when you open up the Art of the Good Dinosaur book, the very front little flap here before you get to the pages is this two-page sweep of dozens of dinosaurs. And I can only imagine that this image is of that version of the film. The rest of the book doesn't seem to really go into that version. Which is a shame. I wish that these productions in the histories could be more transparent a little bit, because I really think that these stories give the film more color and richness. But so what I let me suggest the following, which is that I think that a version like the one you described, Jim, where it's like this Amish community, it's tons and tons of different characters, very inventive stuff going on in every corner. That to me sounds like Pixar. That sounds like something that Pixar has done before. And that's what we want from a Pixar movie. We want the complexity of the plot. We want twists and turns and things like that. I wonder if – well, two things we got as a result of the Pete Sohn version. One is this simple story. I mean, you quote in your article about how kind of moved and relieved Pete and Denise were that they were able to make that it was greenlit to go ahead and make a simple version. That was kind of a special thing, and I can imagine from their perspective, they must have been very excited. Like, wow, we get to make something that Pixar has never really made before. Just a very simple thing. And then the other thing is that leads to the complexity of the backgrounds. Do you suppose that in the Bob Peterson version, we would have gotten the USGS, data and the backgrounds that would have been so much of a huge element of the film? I wonder. Any thoughts?
I don't think so. Yeah. I'm just looking at Jim's article right now.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing these toys I looked at them earlier today and I haven't seen them before. And I'm also looking at that piece of art that has like dinosaurs kind of lined up. Is that maybe what this covered? And also the poster, and I'm seeing like it looks like it's a totally different art style from what we get in, because later in the article I see the Arlo's family along the mountains, and even the character designs, while they're cartoony in the final movie, they are still really rugged and kind of like, especially the T-Rexes, these look like wildly different from almost like those toys almost look like kind of a 1950s like UPA style of what a dinosaur would look like,
right?
Which is really cool and reminds me a lot of kind of like Inside Out's art style, to a shocking degree. And so based on those dinosaurs, I see kind of a wildly different movie, and one that doesn't remind me in the slightest of an Amish community kind of theme, whereas I look at Arlo's family and I'm like, oh, those are probably dinosaur farmers. Yeah. Like, if there is such a thing, that's what they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what's intriguing for me, in fact, it's interesting you about the poster that was out there. In fact, if you look closely at the poster, you notice there's a kind of a blue-green bug.
Right.
You can actually buy this bug at Walmart. In fact, I remember just in the past week walking into the store, and you know how right next to the anti-theft detector, they sort of skin them with, you know, with signs about what's on sale at this point. And they were hyping their Good Dinosaur toys. And here, you know, here's Butch, here's Arlo, here's Spot, and here's a bug that I've never seen before. And, you know, in fact, I went back to the aisle or was quizzing the woman. And she's like, yeah, we had one. You know, and oh, and there's another shipment coming in tomorrow. If you come in at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, they're going to send us a pack of six little small toys and the bug will be in there. But I mean, I guess for the Pixar completists out there, this is kind of intriguing to it's one thing to look at a book and see the art of what didn't get made. It's quite another thing to, hey, the thing that didn't get made, you can hold it in your hand. But there are two stories related to this. You know, one of them, I was telling you earlier about, you know, the thing is that what Disney does, Disney Consumer Products does, is that, you know, six or eight, you know, let's be honest here, you know, 2 years, 18 months out from the release of the film, they're meeting with vendors, they're meeting with people, you know, the big, their big retail partners, and you know, this is our big film that's coming, and you know, these are the characters from it, and you know, so you sign commitments to deliver so many characters and so much product to, you know, to the Walmarts, the Targets, the, you know, the Toys R Us's, and when you change your story and downsize your cast, you know, you can't necessarily meet, you know, your original agreement. So, you know, in a weird sort of way, they had to bring these characters in. You know, these characters they cut from the film, they still had to create the characters just to honor those agreements. On the other hand, there's a story I heard just over the past couple of days, because I was, you know, talking with folks at Consumer Products trying to, you know, do a follow-up story, because, again, I keep tripping over more of these weird toys. And was talking with a friend who works in Consumer Products, and she flat out said, well, look, Jim, you know, one of the reasons that these were out in stores is the container ships had already left China when they started changing the story. So, you know, they were already coming here in the middle of the ocean, and it's sort of like, hey, you're not in the movie anymore. And so they sat in a warehouse for a while, you know, and, you know, that they created boxes that featured the artwork from this version.
Exactly,
of the Good Dinosaur. But if that then begs the question, where are, if they had already made the toys and they were on their way over, where are the adult Arlos with the longer face? Because, in fact, it's interesting, if you go to the Good Dinosaur art book, there's probably five or six pieces of artwork from the film where he's the young adult Arlo.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you can just tell from the longer snout or how much bigger he is than Spot. So, yeah, that's now my question, that it's not like, oh, so you were not honoring the contract, you already had them. So, you know, I just wonder, are we going to eventually end up, you know, do you remember the story about the old E.T. game that, you know, was so terrible they filled a landfill with them? It didn't sell.
I didn't know. And that.
Yeah, that this, if you Google this, there's this amazing story where I forget the major game builder at that time. It was such a flop that they basically, you know, all the units returned and they buried them in a landfill in Arizona. And then, because it's Arizona and it doesn't rain, you know, people were like, hey, where's that E.T. game? And they actually went down with the equivalent of an archaeological team to this dump, dug down and found hundreds of copies.
You're kidding.
No, seriously. I mean, it, trust me, Google that story, you know, the E.T. game dump or archaeological dig, and it's an amazing story. So that's what I want. I want, in fact, wouldn't that be funny? Would an archaeological dig for a plastic dinosaur? oh man, now I want to do this. All right. So anybody knows, contact, you know, Hunter or myself, or get to just, yeah, we got to find these. We got to find these.
I know. Yeah. Well, it's just, I think for Pixar fans, these toys that are out there, I think are so special, because, you know, we're never going to see toys for Newt or, you know, these things that canceled Pixar ideas, you know, but these are getting the light of day because they kind of had to. And I think it makes you stop and reflect on stuff. And the one thing that I want to, as we kind of wrap up here, one thing that I want to point out is another difference that this production has from some of the others that have swapped directors is that it seems that Bob Peterson is staying at Pixar. Would you agree with that, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, but you know, the interesting thing is there's a history of doing this. There's you know, because Bob is considered one of the genuinely vital story guys.
Yeah.
You know, it just, you know, dates way back. But do you remember when John Carter came out?
Right.
And you know, and again, John Carter didn't, you know, do all that well at the box office, and John Carter underperformed. And this was Monday or Tuesday after the opening weekend, and Bob Iger himself gets out in front of the financial press and basically says, look, you know, sometimes you swing big and you miss big, you know, but we, Disney as a company, made this movie and we got behind it and it didn't happen. And we feel bad, but we're moving on. And, you know, we value what Andrew Stanton tried to do here, and we look very much forward to working with Andrew for many years yet to come.
Yeah.
Okay. Huh. Reading between the lines here is like, we need Andrew to make Finding Nemo 2, you know, and we don't, you know, we're not going to do the stupid thing of like blame him for the $250 million movie that crashed and burned, you know, because we don't want him walking away and making movies for DreamWorks or Sony or Blue Sky. So it's like, you know, this is our fault. You know, Andrew did a really great movie and you're all stupid. You didn't come see it. And hey, Andrew, when are you going to get started on that Finding Nemo 2? Mm. You know, so, you know, this is part of this really is all about keeping talent on the reservation.
Yeah.
So, all right. So Bob labored for a long time and couldn't get it to work. And it's like, okay, we're going to bring somebody else in. But it's like every, you know, that's the, you know, when you think about all the stories coming out of Pixar about it's okay to fail, just fail quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the only thing that anybody holds against Bob is that he didn't fail quickly. I mean, they started developing this in 2009, and it wasn't till 2013 they finally went, not working, but okay, Bob, step away. But can you join us here? You know, I mean, if I remember correctly, Bob, you know, in fact, you want to talk irony, Bob leaves, you know, working on Good Dinosaur. What's he working on? But the troubled, you know, Finding Nemo sequel, you know, you know, they need somebody to help them figure out how to deal with the blackfish situation. So get Bob in here,
yeah.
You know, and from what we're going to hear, he fixed it. So, you know, I'm glad that Pixar has that sort of culture, you know, that, you know, in Hollywood, you know, success has all sorts of fathers, but failure, you know, they always look for one guy to blame. And invariably, it's the director or the writer or, you know, the person that takes the hit, not the executive who greenlit the movie.
Yeah.
So it's kind of sweet that Pixar is like, okay, you screwed up. Never mind. Get over here and Dory. We need help.
And he does it. Yeah, he does it.
And he does it. Yeah. You know, I love he's still in the building. And I really hope he gets another shot at directing. More to the point, I really want Pixar. I want Pixar to recognize that Peter Song,
yes,
you know, look, you handed him the Hindenburg,
yes,
okay, and he landed it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
You know, give this guy another shot at directing.
I agree.
Him another project. You know, he and Denise took a project, you know, that was, you know, she described in being in the middle of the story Merck.
Yep.
And they found a movie. They found a great movie.
Yeah.
They should be rewarded for that.
Yeah.
If the, you know, I'm sorry that it didn't make money now, though, again, just quoting history here, there's a famous story about Walt Disney and Fantasia Two things, you know, because obviously Fantasia came out, cost $3 million to make, only made $1.1 million at the box office, you know, huge flop for that era. In fact, a famous story of the Academy Awards of that year, Walt was issued the Gene Herschel Award, and he stood on stage. In fact, I'm serious. You can get the book called The Envelope, Please. They print the speech. And basically, Walt stands on stage and apologizes for Fantasia.
Huh.
He actually says, you know, we're going to return to our core values. We reach too far, you know, and we're not going to do that again. And then jump ahead to 1961. Peter Martin, a Canadian journalist, is doing hours and hours of interviews with Walt for a piece. And Walt, you know, leans across the desk and he's like, Pete's like, you seem in a happy mood. What's going on? And he says, I just got a memo. You know, and it's like Fantasia finally came into the black, you know, and it's like, you know, so I'm off the hook.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to feel bad about wasting the company's money.
Yeah. And
sometimes it takes decades for a movie to, you know, especially the way Hollywood keeps the books. Mm-hmm. You know, that sometimes it takes a long time for a movie to make money to be considered a success. And
yeah,
it may take, you know, and given all the money that was burned through doing The Good Dinosaur, it may take a while for this to be considered a financial success. But it's a success now. It's a great story. All right. And, it, you know, anyone who actually sits and watches this movie loves it. And, you know, just I'm hoping that in my lifetime, you know, give this thing 20 years or so, it'll get recognized and do well, you know, as well as everyone had hoped at the box office. But it's still a great movie.
Yeah. At the end of the day, yeah, it's a movie that I think reflects Pete Soane's sensibilities that are different from, you know, Andrew Stanton, Pete Docter, John Lasseter. These guys are geniuses, and yet they all kind of come from the same ilk in some ways. And Brad Bird was the outsider coming in with The Incredibles a little bit, but they're all, you know, it's like, to me, they're all kind of part of the same, like, CalArts class. I know they were a little bit apart, but that they all kind of were formed in the same kind of genius box. And Pete Soane, I think, brings something new and fresh. And so I agree with you, Jim. I really hope that he gets another chance to do something, because I think that he has proven himself to be able to take a difficult situation and not worry about anything else, but paring it down to how can we make this the best movie that it can be. And I think that he really nailed it there. So,
agree.
Well, Jim, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. I hope that you come back on the podcast sometime. There's more that I'd love to talk to you about in the future. So thank you for coming on.
No. Thank you for the invite, and you know, frankly, also enjoyed, you know, hearing Hunter's insights about the film. I love hearing another film wonk talk.
Yes,
you know,
me
bring
too.
Bring him back.
Me too.
You know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Hunter, anything else you'd like to add for sort of before we close out here today?
No. I love this movie so much. I totally agree with what you're saying. Maybe we should do an episode in the future where we talk about the CalArts house styles that have come up over the years.
Yeah.
Based on their classes, because I think the same thing happened in the last few years, and has happened in the wake of Flapjack and Adventure Time.
Yeah.
There's a real house style out of that class too.
Yeah. Fascinating. Well, it's always great to have you on, Hunter. You always bring really great insights. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
No, thanks for having me.
And well, listeners, again, the show notes for this episode are at thepixarpodcast.com/130. You can see some of the links to some of the stuff we've talked about today. And if you haven't seen The Good Dinosaur, I know everyone has that's listened to the Pixar podcast, but go out and see it again, give it some love, and especially find these toys. I would imagine that these designs will never be made again, even in the future if Good Dinosaur toys continue to be made. You know, I kind of got the sense that these things are just going to be, you know, run out, and then there's no need to have them back. So go get yours now, because I think that these will be real Pixar collectibles in the future. So Jim Hill and Hunter Phillips, thanks again. Listeners, that's it. See you next time.
Okay, Squirt here will now give you a rundown of proper exiting technique.
Mom, it's just a ball.
Don't let it happen again.
Yes, well, I'll try to be less careless.
It's got this kind of squirty, melty, it's not really a smoky taste. It's a certain, it's kind of like a it's kind of like this boom sap kind of taste. Don't you think? What would you call that flavor?
Lightning?
Don't
Don't look at the light!
I can't help it. It's so beautiful.
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you.
Gone! It's all gone. All of it's gone. Bye-bye. Woo, see ya.
Thank you for listening to the Pixar Podcast.